When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second-guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-.
So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at PlushCare.com/weight loss. That's PlushCare.com/weight loss. PlushCare.com/weight loss.
What's up, y'all? It's Drewski, and I've teamed up with Mountain Dew to produce a hilarious new basketball podcast called The Dew Zone with Drewski. Learn the backstories of your favorite ballers and celebrities like Jamal Murray.
Did you have, like, a favorite team? Was it the Raptors at the time or no? Was the Raptors even started around that time?
Come on, bro.
I ain't that old, fam. You're talking like I'm 50.
Taylor Rooks, Asia Wilson, and many more. You won't want to miss this. Listen to The Dew Zone with Drewski on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and wherever you listen to podcasts.
Chase Thomas podcast. The Chase Thomas podcast. My nephew needs me to record. See, I already hate it.
All right, we're back on a Tuesday afternoon edition of the Chase Thomas podcast. Old friend, the Dunkin' Donut God himself, Connor Ryan. Connor, good afternoon, sir. How are you?
I'm doing very well, Chase. How are you doing?
I'm good, man. I feel like I saw on either Twitter or your Instagram, your Dunkin' apartment. Like, you have Dunkin' Donuts merch. Like, what is the extent right now of your Dunkin' Donuts branding?
Well, I keep it pretty low key. It's only a bathrobe right now. So nothing too flashy, right? So they have that on sale right around the holiday season, and it popped up and it was selling out quick. And I'm like, should I do it? Mm-hmm. And please don't. I was like, I have to do it. So it was well worth the $35 I spent, which honestly, pretty good value for a pretty solid bathrobe. I have no regrets at all.
I think if I got something similar, because I'm more of a Dunkin' guy than a Starbucks guy, like, I think the girlfriend would probably break up with me, right? Like, that's a non-starter. Like, just to walk around with the Dunkin' Donuts bathrobe. I don't know. Is that a thing I could pull off?
I mean, I think it looks good. You know, it's got good color scheme. Again,
I'm pale, so I don't think the color scheme actually works for me. The pink and orange, I don't know.
It's working against you. But hey, the most important thing, though, it's comfortable. So, I mean, that's all that really matters, right?
I don't know. I think how you look matters way more than being comfortable. I'm definitely someone who prioritizes how something looks over comfortability.
You were in a Dunkin' bathroom. You got to take some. That's right. If you.
Oh man, I love it. What is your go to Dunkin' order at the moment?
Right now I'm switching up a little bit, but I get a large. I switched to large with the way this year's gone. I have to get a large coffee now. Large iced caramel swirl, and I've actually been trying oat milk. I'm gonna tell you, it's delightful.
Oat milk.
Yeah,
I'm an almond milk guy. I like almond milk. Oat milk. Great. You also feel better. It's hard to go back if you start switching over your milk preferences, because you're like, oh, this other shit's too heavy. Can't do it.
Exactly. No, absolutely.
All right, man. Well, I appreciate you making the time. It's good to talk some hockey with you today. Don't forget, you can listen to us on Apple, Spotify. Go check out ChaseThomasPodcast.com. Go follow Connor and all of his great work at the Boston Sports Journal. Connor, we have some news items to hit.
Absolutely.
John... you know what I don't like, Connor? You know what I don't like?
What is that?
how difficult it is for me to pronounce two-thirds of hockey names in my life. No other sport I have to worry about this. I mean, sometimes baseball a little bit, but like as a professional broadcaster, it wears me out. And that's why I've always opined that NHL play-by-play broadcasters are the best in the business, because I have no fucking idea how they're able to do it with the speed and clarity that the broadcasters are, because it's insane some of the names that you just have to know how to pronounce ahead of time. John Tortorella denies benching Pierre-Luc Dubois. What do you think about that? Because his quote was hilarious after saying that that's just part of the... He didn't even realize that he wasn't part of any lines yesterday. What do you make of all of that?
Yeah, I'm pretty surprised, because usually it would be well within Tortorella's character just to admit that he benched a guy. Like, he usually doesn't give a shit. So it's like making like this like ham-fisted excuse about it. I just find hilarious, because I mean, you look at that Columbus team, and yeah, even though they play a good, you know, team defense and everyone buys in, they're not really stacked with star power, especially up front. So you don't really have a good excuse to not play your first line center like under 16 minutes a night. So obviously something seems to be up there, and you know, I think we can all draw what the natural reason is that Dubois asked for a trade before the year, and he's still here, and it seems like no one's really happy about it. So does that mean that we're gonna have a situation where everything kind of goes to shit, like, you know, a James Harden situation? Probably not. Like, I feel like Columbus is gonna wait it out and see what the offers are, but you can clearly tell this team that already seems to be in a bit of a transition, they got this extra drama adding on, which I guess when you have John Tortorella as your coach, you deal with the drama to get the results. But seems like this Columbus team's still now a few years away from being legitimate contenders, especially if they trade their top player.
Well, it's also weird, too, because it seems like forever ago, pre-pandemic, that they went all in, right? Like, they made a bunch of win-now moves. It didn't happen. They went a little bit further than we thought they would. But, like, ever since then, it's just been this gradual decline. And like you said, they're a couple years away from, at the very least, of contending again. And the timelines may not match up with Pierre, but, like, what is his value like? Is it worth it for the Blue Jackets to actually move him now?
I feel like it's probably for them, it's going to be waiting until, I wouldn't be surprised if it's the offseason around the draft to get a better idea of kind of what his value is. Again, if this situation devolves and he's just not playing, or, you know, Tortorella's scratching him or playing him 9 minutes a night, all right, then you probably have to pull the trigger on a trade. But I feel like, especially with this whole season where you've got a flat salary cap and teams are scared to open up their wallets or do any deals just in terms of that flat cap, I feel like Columbus is probably best positioned to wait until the offseason to see what they can get for him, because it's not like you're going to waste a year of Pierre-Luc Dubois' career by not trading him now. I mean, he's 22 years old. Like, he's got, you know, 8-9 years of prime left before he even should, you know, develop into still a guy who should age pretty gracefully. So you look at kind of his value, I think it's going to hold pretty steady for the next couple years anyway. So it's probably a smart move for Columbus to wait it out. But as for what his value is, I mean, it's always tough to gauge what the value is for hockey trades, because you always hear when guys hit the market, like Mark Stone, before he got traded to Vegas, everyone was like, oh, you're going to have to give up a arm and a leg for this guy. And then Vegas trades for him. And we all looked at like the report and we're like, that's it. That's all you got for him. So it's tough to really gauge. I mean, it's going to be the usual young prospects and, you know, maybe two first round picks or something like that. But in hockey, it's very rare you get a guy like Dubois with his skill set and his age on the market. So I think whatever team eventually trades for him, my hunch will be Montreal is what it's going to end up being. I think, you know, it's going to be well worth the return is for getting a guy like him in the fold.
What an abject disaster, though. Like, it's not, he's 22. He is, he was drafted number 3 overall 4 years ago. It's insane that this is where they're at. Like, this doesn't happen in hockey very often, right?
No, absolutely. That's why I think I think there was a report that said about 25 teams are interested, which again, I think is, you know, a testament to the fact that you don't get a guy who's 22, who's got term or 2 years left on his deal, available, you know, just in any potential trade situation. So it makes sense that every team's interested. Now, does every team have the assets? No, but there's, you know, at least 7 or 8 teams who have the picks and the prospects to be a viable contender if they start taking bids right away.
It's going to be interesting to see what ultimately happens. What is your best guess? Where do you think it's the Canadians, or is there a alternate like, ooh, this would be interesting and also plausible?
Yeah, I think Montreal is where he wants to go. I think there was reports about that he was interested in that, which makes sense as a guy from Quebec.
But if you're the Blue Jackets, you're like, yeah, you can go fuck yourself. Because if you're going to ask out at 22, we're going to be like, we're going to send you wherever the best deal is. We're not going to placate where you want to go.
Yeah, so I mean, Montreal could at least make an offer because they've got a lot of good young players. I think you look to the West Coast, the Kings, Ducks, they've got an absurd amount.
Yes, I'm here for it. Let's go.
I mean, they've got an absurd amount of talent in their pipeline that they could trade on top of first round picks. So they'd be an appealing team if that's a team that, you know, it's not like you're giving away the entire farm. So you still identify three or four guys to build around with a guy like Dubois, and all of a sudden you've got a pretty good team in the next 2-3 years. So I wouldn't be surprised if one of those teams out west targets him as well. I'm sure that's what Columbus would rather have, right? They'd rather have him than have him be the first line center that Montreal's been looking for 20 plus years. Like, Montreal's had some good teams over the years since last time they won the cup, but they've always have missed out on having a first line center. So getting a guy like Dubois in the fall would be huge for them.
For sure. The Stars set to open their season January 22nd. It's just insane that we're just doing this NHL season. They're just like, yeah, we're not there yet. We'll be there at some point. With our neon uniforms, we'll appear at some point. What do you make of the Stars starting their season on the 22nd?
Yeah, it's going to be an interesting kind of ramp up for them. It's, you know, people are like, well, you know, at least they have more time off. I'm like, well, they weren't practicing. Like, their place was closed, like their practice facilities. And now, like, you're already going into this year, I think for most teams, it was 56 games and I think like 114 days. Now it's even more compressed for the Stars. So you're going to get more and more back-to-backs and more, you know, 3 and 4s, and that stuff adds up over the course of an NHL season. So will Dallas still be, I think, one of the best teams in their division? Of course. I mean, I think that any team coming off the Stanley Cup final appearance, you know, there's always the teams that are the fluke, they go that far, but Dallas is built for success where they've got a really good decor and Heiskanen and Klingberg and Lindell and all these other guys. They got two good goalies, you know, a lot of younger players up front who kind of broke out during the playoffs this past year. So they'll be right in the mix, but it's definitely a tough ask when I think you get through this whole season. And I think this is going to be an issue for a lot of teams this year, just how compressed the schedule is. If you don't have two competent goalies back there to, you know, share the workload, then you're going to have a lot of guys who are going to be gassed by the time you get to the playoffs. So you look at a team like Toronto or any of these teams that really only have one guy they kind of put all their hopes on. I feel like you're going to have a lot of these guys be pretty gassed once you get to the playoffs. So Dallas is better equipped than most in terms of dealing with kind of how this impacted the start of their season, but still, it's not an ideal situation to say the least, which we could say about any sports league in 2020-21, right? Not ideal.
Not ideal, Bob. Last news item I want to touch on. The Coyotes add Jay Verity to their coaching staff. Any thoughts there?
Yeah, I mean, you kind of look at the track record he had down in Tucson, building a pretty legit AHL team down there, and he should be a good addition to the Coyotes, because the thing with the Coyotes is, as much as they've got some promising young talent, you look at a guy like, you know, Clayton Keller, you look at Connor Garland, who is a good pickup for them, kind of out of nowhere. He's become a top six forward for them. Seems like they always have a lot of skill, but under Rick Tocchet's system, where they seem like very contained and, you know, structurally sound, usually means they win a lot of, you know, 2-1 games, you know, 3-2, stuff like that. So hopefully, you know, adding him to the mix and the coaching staff opens up a little bit and they're able to get going, because they've got guys who can finish in transition. They got some, you know, offensive firepower. It's just, I think, catering and tweaking your system to best suit some of those guys, because the Coyotes, you know, a threat in the West? Probably not yet, but they still got good pieces that, you know, you should build around.
Absolutely, absolutely. Vegas, Golden Knights are undefeated right now. Are you a believer this early in the season in the Vegas Golden Knights?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, it's one thing when you look at that team who's been, you know, they go to the cup final their first year, and then the next 2 years, they've both been very, very good. Like, you take that team that's pretty much all back, then you add Alex Pietrangelo to the mix, you retain Robin Lehner to have a 1-2 punch in net with him and Fleury. Like, I don't see how you can't view that team as being a legitimate Stanley Cup contender. I think probably with Colorado in the West, at least. I mean, those two teams look absolutely stacked. And again, you look at Vegas's roster, it's like where do you really kind of find the flaw in that lineup, right? They've got a crazy amount of depth up front. Mark Stone, I think, is one of the probably the most underrated player in the NHL in terms of everything he does. You know, he's a fantastic winger for them, does a little bit of everything. Great defensively. He should win a Selkie before his career is over. Again, Petrangelo is leading that D-core. You've got a lot of other good puck movers there. Again, they've got the two good goalies, which is going to mean a lot during this compressed schedule. So you kind of look at everything. It's like, where do you kind of really find the flaw? Like, the only reason why the Vegas wasn't probably the one seed in the West the last 2 years is that they kind of fell victim to being snake bit quite a bit. I mean, they were always at the top in terms of those fancy stats, like expected goals and everything, where they're, you know, putting the puck in the right area. It's just they're not going in the net, right? So, like, they're doing everything right. They come in waves on offense. They've got a sound defensive structure. So you look at this team and the additions they made, the fact they didn't lose anyone, it's pretty impressive what they've built out there in the span of a couple of years. I mean, they look like a wagon right now.
For sure. For sure. The team that you cover, the Boston Bruins, what are your early season thoughts? How is this team playing, and how much of it is about what you expect it coming in?
Well, there are some good positives. I mean, you lose a guy like Zdeno Chara and Torey Krug. You worry about the defense. But as a whole, you know, they play a zone defensive system anyway. And, you know, they adhere to that pretty strictly. So far, it's been pretty good. Both goalies have been great in Tuukka Rask and Yaroslav Halak. So, again, that helps them out quite a bit in a season like this when you got those two guys to rely on. However, they've yet to score a goal at 5-on-5 or even strength at all this year, which is not ideal. It's usually pretty good if you're scoring goals. So the fact they have not in three games is not what you're looking for. The only other team that hasn't scored an even strength goal this year is the Dallas Stars, who have not even played a game yet. So that's not good when you're in the same boat as them opening the year. So, again, they're missing David Pastrnak, who's arguably the best goal scorer in the league. So once he comes back within the next week or two, that should help them out quite a bit. But, again, it's one of those ones where you don't want to rush to panic over a three-game sample where it's not like they're, you know, a black hole on offense, right? It's not like they're not getting any pucks on net. It's just more or less, you know, the pucks aren't falling their way right now. So the fact that they're not getting, you know, shit-canned and getting beat 5-1, 6-0 or anything like that. Like, they're losing 1-0. They lost in overtime the day prior. The fact that they still got a good defensive system, they got two good goalies, you know, I think they'll be fine. But I think the onus is now on Pastrnak to get back in a timely order, because you kind of miss his game-breaking ability where, all right, the other team might have a good defense, but you know, few guys can stop Pastrnak's one time or when he's locked in. So his return should help the team out quite a bit.
In your estimation, do you believe the Vancouver Canucks will win a hockey game this season?
Well, right now it's not looking too good. However, I would imagine eventually luck will go their way. But you kind of look at Vancouver right now and they're almost like the Bruins a little bit, and that just seems like nothing's going their way. But at least the Bruins are, you know, have been buoyed by the fact that they've got, you know, a good defense and a good goalie tandem. Like, nothing's going well for the Canucks right now. I mean, their power play is 0-for-15. They've allowed 7 power play goals on 21 chances for their PK. The younger players who you expected were going to take big steps forward, and Pettersson and Hughes, haven't done anything. I don't think Pettersson even has a point on the year, and he's got like 4 or 5 penalties. So he's obviously frustrated. Yeah, I mean, it's a tough start for Vancouver, because I think for as much as fans there were worried about, you know, their cap situation and how they're handling all these different contracts, at least you're still, you know, you have that backup plan, and that you've got probably the best young core in the NHL. And when they're not performing, when, you know, your special teams is in a slump, it's tough to really kind of find much positives right now with that team, especially when they lose to the Flames and their old goalie Jacob Markstrom looks great in net for them. And they've got Demko and Braden Holtby, who, as much as people, you know, appreciate Holtby in his career with the Capitals. I mean, he had a pretty brutal last year in Washington. Like, he may not be the same Holtby that I think hockey fans are used to seeing during his kind of glory days with Washington. So, if that young core for Vancouver is not, you know, consistently kind of driving the play, then they're going to be in some trouble this year.
Yeah, I'm not feeling great. Not feeling great. Speaking of not feeling great, this is where we can wrap up here today, Connor. The Detroit Red Wings, who are not good at hockey, like a couple other teams, like the Canucks, like the Kings, like the Sharks, maybe. In your estimation, are they the worst team in hockey this season?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, they were absolutely brutal last year as well, and they're still, you know, I think quite a few years away from being viable contenders. I mean, even look at their prospect pipeline. Like, they got some good young players. They added some players during, you know, this past year in the draft. But for a team that probably thought they were getting the number one overall pick, or at least a top three pick, I think they picked fourth overall, I want to say. I think they got the worst possible odds as to what they could have got based on what their record was. So, and yeah, you look at a team like that compared to maybe another team that's rebuilding, like the Senators. Like, the Senators are still maybe a few years away, but you look at their younger players like Brady Tkachuk and Tim Stützle and all these other younger players, and you can at least be like, all right, another year or two, we suck, but we get another probably good draft pick, and these guys are going to be much, much better in a year or two. You look at Detroit, it's all like spare parts, or it's guys who, you know, are first round, second round pick, but they're not going to be a franchise player. They might be a good third line guy. So you kind of look at Detroit, they've got a lot more to work on, and it's going to be pretty ugly for the next couple of years, I think, because there's no light at the end of the tunnel really yet. They're still in that part of rebuilding where you're kind of moving off those bad contracts and trying to just plug in guys and hoping that some of these younger players pan out for them, which so far really hasn't been the case that much.
Yeah, I don't think the Red Wings are in good shape. I think this is from the Hockey News, a very good hockey website that you all should check out. At 5-on-5 so far, two games, they've been outshot 61-29 and outchanced 53-32. They sit dead last in 5-on-5 expected goals for percentage after ranking second to last the season prior, and it was the lowest point percentage since the 1999-2000. Atlanta's own Atlanta Thrashers, Believe in Blue Land. This is not a stat you want to be in. You never want to be in an early Atlanta Thrasher stat.
No, not at all. Especially a team like Detroit, who's been, a wagon for, you know, 50-plus years. Now everything's kind of coming home to roost for them, unfortunately.
But they were a team, like, fighting the rebuild, like, with Holland and everything. They really put this off. They're kind of, like, in that Blackhawk zone, these prestigious long-term teams that just, like, have been mismanaged for several years now, and even if you think they're moving in the right direction now, like, it's gonna be painful because of the moves they made several years ago and just kind of being pseudo contenders and not really doing the full teardown. Like, that it's gonna be a lot more painful, and I think it's gonna go on a little bit longer than fans from both those franchises would hope for.
Yeah, no, I mean, I think it, especially in hockey too, I think people should be more aware of the merit of just, again, ripping off the Band-Aid and just embracing the suck for a couple of years, because all in considered, hockey is usually pretty good in terms of rebuilding on the fly. I mean, people thought Montreal 2-3 years ago was going to be in shambles for years, and all of a sudden they look like they're on the up and up just by getting a few guys that, you know, have overachieved maybe in their roles, plus you get a lot of good young prospects added to the system. So all of a sudden they feel like they're a team on the rise. I mean, you've got the Ducks, for as much as they've been struggling, you'll get their prospect line, and it's just crazy. Like, that man, the Kings, again, are they going to be good this year? No, but you still feel like in another year or two, they're going to have three or four, like, legitimate, like, top flight guys, you know, in the mix. So yeah, you look at a team like Detroit and a team like Chicago, like, you guys should have, you know, pulled the plug back in 2015 and probably be contenders again, or at least be a team that's gives its fans something to look forward to of, like, all right, you know, we're still – it's kind of like the Rangers this year, right? Like, the Rangers aren't going to be, a playoff team, but they're going to be fun to watch. They got a lot of good young players that should have fans excited. Like, I don't see that same kind of excitement from, you know, Red Wings or Blackhawks fans this year.
No, not at all. All right, Connor. Well, this has been great. I appreciate you making the time as always, good sir. What can we check out from you this week in the Boston Sports Journal?
Yeah, we're going to be breaking down, obviously, the Bruins' biggest flaw has been their lack of scoring. So we're going to do a little bit of a deep dive into that, see where problems are plaguing them right now in the offensive zone. So we're looking at that. We're doing a few features that we're excited to roll out in the next couple weeks. So you can follow all the stuff we churn out over at BostonSportsJournal.com. So subscribe there. And if you want to follow me on Twitter, you can follow me at @ConnorRyan_93. That's Connor with one N.
There you go. You know I had to do it to him, Connor. So this is how we have to end. As we have to end every podcast. You know what I'm going to ask you.
Of course.
Are you a cop?
I'm not a fucking cop.
Sugar Ray Leonard, Roberto Duran, Marvelous Marvin Hagler, and Thomas Hearns. Legends, whose four-way rivalry defined one of the greatest eras in boxing history. Relive their decade of dominance in the new Showtime sports documentary, The Kings, a four-part series premiering Sunday, June 6th, only on Showtime.
All right, we're back on the Chase Thomas podcast. I am joined, as I am every single Tuesday, by the great John Taylor of Fangraphs up there in Manhattan, New York. I'm just going to say Manhattan now, John. I can't keep the Brooklyn boy going anymore. I should be accurate.
I appreciate that you're not pushing that filthy lie any further.
What lie would you prefer me to substitute the Brooklyn boy lie? Is there something you have in mind about your life that you would like me to push instead?
Yeah, sure. You can tell people that I am a billionaire industrialist by day, but that by night I'm a masked vigilante out to avenge the deaths of my parents.
There you have it, folks. I didn't reveal it, but that guy right there, I think you know who he is.
Yeah, in retrospect, I probably shouldn't have said that out loud, but you know what? It's okay.
2021, man. We got to get everything out there in the open. And you were going to be found out at some point, John.
Yeah. So it's all about being honest. And getting myself arrested.
Well, you can listen on ChaseThomasPodcast.com. You can listen on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, if you're an Apple Podcast listener. John Taylor and Fisher, especially Fisher, would prefer you leave us a five-star rating and a review and telling us why you like listening to John and I talk about baseball, which is a very healthy and fun sport to talk about, where two-thirds at minimum of the league is trying to win a World Series in 2021. Couple news items to hit, John. We were texting about last night the news that broke very late in the evening, early morning. Swift action from Steve Cohen, the owner of the New York Mets. Jared Porter has been fired by the New York Mets for harassment and everything involved in this insane texting scandal. And there are so many layers to this. This was just a bombshell last night reported by Jeff Passan and Mina Kimes of ESPN. What do you make of all of this, John?
I mean, first and foremost, obviously, it's horrifying. Like, all the details in this story are just so upsetting. 62.
I texted you 62. We will never be able to wrap our heads around 62.
62 unanswered text messages, just consistent. Ending, of course, with the go-to move for every type of person who decides that 62 straight texts is the right way to go, which is just, here's a picture of my genitals.
Or a stock image? What did he say that was?
And then the absolutely just mind-blowing like lie that he came up with. That wasn't my penis. That was a stock photo that I sent as a joke. Because if that somehow is A, believable, and B, makes it any better. I mean, there are a lot of details in it that are just, like hard to wrap your head around. But to me, the thing that stands out is just this reporter, this unnamed reporter, the fact that she chooses to go anonymous, even because this happened like a few years ago now at this point, and this has been I think they noted, Passan noted in that story that this is something that that reporter that he, I can't remember if it's he or other reporters, have had for at least a couple of years, but that the victim didn't want to push forward with it for fear of retribution. And I mean, that's like those details like that, the fact that, you know, that she didn't want to come forward because she was afraid of what it would mean for her career. The fact that when she brought it to the Cubs, whoever she interacted with, whatever unnamed Cubs official she interacted with, basically told her not to push the issue and that it could actually be a benefit for her, that she was forced to go to a team interpreter to get Porter to stop because she, because as the piece notes, she's a foreign reporter or was a foreign reporter who for whom English is not a first language. The fact that he, after receiving that message, apologized, but then said, if I can be of any help work-wise, let me know, which is just an incredible bit of, like, disassociation and just mental, like, that to me is just the crazy part. You think that after everything you just sent, you can just go back to a normal working relationship. The fact that she just didn't want to be anywhere around him, that she would refuse assignments that would put her in any kind of proximity to him. And then to me, what felt like the inevitable ending, which is she left journalism. And even more so than this being a story about, you know, a very gross man and his very gross attempts to, you know, to exercise his position and power over someone who is new to the industry and who also, even more appalling, like, does not speak English or doesn't speak English well enough to, you know, to kind of, I don't want to say fight back, but, just, you know, targeting someone who is already kind of, what's the phrase I'm looking for here? Basically lacks the power really to do anything about this or the ability to do anything about this. But that to me is just the part which is, you know, that she left the industry because of course she did. You know, this is what happens to women who work in the sports industry is that eventually the constant toll of these daily or regular humiliations, and it's not always as obvious or blatant as, you know, dick pics or texting or harassment via texting or stuff like that. There's so many, you know, started from having talked to my, you know, the women I know in the industry and in sports media and then elsewhere, just the constant indignities, embarrassments, aggression, humiliations, assaults that you just face on a seemingly never ending level from people who should at the very least know better, who should not be doing this kind of, like, what excuse does Jared Porter have? You know, not that he necessarily needs an excuse, but this is coming from someone that, you know, when he was hired, there were so many reporters saying, you know, this guy who's well-liked around the game, which says plenty on itself, is considered a good person. And then we have this. It's, to me, just the fact that this woman chose to leave this industry because of everything that happened is just emblematic of the way that the culture around baseball and the culture around sports in general is just so both toxic and repulsive to women, and the way that it doesn't allow for a space for them to exist. Like, this woman was simply trying to do her job. She never showed, and this isn't something like, not that it would excuse it either way, but this is not like a romantic relationship gone bad. You know, this woman never showed any interest in Jared Porter, never responded to his text with anything other than an attempt to be professional. And even at some points, just simply like, cordial, you know, obviously I am not a woman, but from, again, talking to women in the industry, I understand that, you know, that kind of messaging back where you're just trying to be nice and just kind of hope that, okay, if I'm nice, maybe this guy will leave me alone. Maybe this guy will stop being so creepy and weird. You know, she was simply trying to do her job, and instead she got targeted and harassed and assaulted by this horrible piece of shit. And now she doesn't have that job anymore. You know, and this is what happens. Women do not feel safe in this industry. They don't feel like people have their best interests in mind. They feel like they are constantly trying to fight against a wave of sexism and misogyny and just outright, like I said, like just assault. And I know that, you know, we, it's funny in not funny, but it's just this thing. It's like we seemingly get this story like two or we hear about this story like two or three times a year, and there's so many other stories, like 10 to 100, who knows how many times as many, that we're not hearing because someone hasn't come out and said anything, or because what's happened isn't at the level of, you know, being sent a dick pic or whatever. again, the whole culture, the whole industry, it's just, and it's not something where it's like, you know, baseball is creating this. It's just, but because this exists in other industries as well. This isn't just a baseball specific problem. But when it comes to Major League Baseball, it's just that mindset of, well, I mean, these are the sport just has not done the work necessary to make this sport and this industry, the baseball media industry, feel like a safe place for women to work. And it's getting, I think it is getting better, but at the same time, you know, you see stuff like this, and again, all the stuff we haven't heard, just how far there is to go. And I don't know what the solution is. You know, I'm certainly not an expert on that kind of stuff, but it's so disheartening just to see this continue to happen over and over again. And just, you know, she is obviously the victim, but that really is just the thing that I cannot let go of in this story, that this woman had to give up on her career because of this, because this stupid, stupid asshole simply could not understand the concept of no. You know, he simply could not understand, like, leave her alone, basically. And it's one of the things, like, you know, that is just a simple, like, society. That's not even baseball. That's a societal thing. It's like you have to find a way to make it understood, like, to our entire gender, our entire very stupid gender, that this kind of behavior is not acceptable. It is not okay. It is beyond wrong. And until that happens, and especially until that happens, but given, you know, especially given the people who are in baseball, which is, you know, a very male-centric, male-dominated industry, this kind of thing is just going to keep happening. You know, we just have to keep trying to push forward, but it's just so disappointing to see it continue to happen like that.
Yeah, I was still kind of pleasantly surprised that this was as swift as it was, though, right? Like, they were just like, nope. Like, if the Wilpons were owning, if the Wilpons were still in power, do you think this happens as swiftly and as quickly and as demonstrably as they did it?
I'm of two minds. One is that the Wilpons, obviously, I mean, especially Jeff Wilpon, has his own sordid history of harassment and misogyny. So that complicates things a little bit. But on the other hand, I do think that what made this such an easy call for the Mets, that, you know, we didn't have the usual, like, 3 or 4 days of hemming and hawing and, you know, and outcry, is that there was visual, hard textual evidence, literally textual. Like, you know, because ESPN had all the receipts, so to speak, they had all the texts, you know, they had Porter admitting, even if he lied in the process, that, you know, he did text this woman. There wasn't really an investigation to be done. This wasn't a he said, she said scenario. This was, this dude did this, here is the proof. Once the proof comes out, there's the only direction you could go is, hey, this dude's got to go. Like I said, maybe with the Wilpons, it would have played a little slower because they are incompetent at everything. And also because Jeff Wilpon is a creep in his own way. But I don't think they really, not even so much, had any choice. Like, clearly, like, they had to do this. You know, they would have, if I were in charge of the Mets, it'd be done regardless of, you know, evidence or a lack thereof. But with the, you know, with the evidence that they had now, this was something that was just like an immediate, obvious, like, no, this guy's got to go.
Yeah, this is mind-blowing. So what do you think they're going to do next? Do they immediately hire somebody new? Do they promote from within?
Sure. I mean, obviously they'll have to hire somebody. I mean, maybe they let Zach Scott do things for now, because it is pretty late in the offseason to hire another GM, and they just try again next year. They just have Alderson and Scott kind of run things. I don't know. It's always the weird thing about when stuff like this happens, like when a player gets suspended for domestic violence, it's like, what does the team do next? It's like, yeah, is that really the story here? Is it the story that this guy is a super creep who represents all the worst parts of the society and culture in which he lives? You know, especially because with the Mets, like, something too, like we saw with the Astros, and who cares about firing a general manager? You know, a front office is more than just one guy. And this dude also has probably not even had very much time to set up a front office anyway. So I assume the Mets will just hand power over to a combination of Sandy Alderson and Zach Scott and just go from there and probably try again next winter. But I mean, if you're a Mets fan, what has to be concerning is this is now two straight off seasons that they have completely bungled their vetting of a very important hire. Last year, obviously, with Carlos Beltran, where they just seemed kind of blindsided by the sign-stealing stuff, despite the fact that it was a pretty open secret around the game that Beltran was one of the kind of ringleaders of that in Houston. And now, again, with Porter, this stuff somehow not coming up, despite the fact that it happened when Porter was with the Cubs. It happened a few years ago. It happened enough to a degree that reporters knew about it, that clearly someone in the Cubs organization knew about it. I am sure that this is something other people knew about, too. I can't imagine this stayed a secret just between Porter, the victim, the reporter, and one Cubs official. And as far as we know, one Cubs official. I know the Cubs put out a statement that said that they had never heard about anything like this. The Diamondbacks, who Porter worked for after Chicago, said the same thing. And this is the thing, like, this is the thing with Porter and with guys who do this kind of stuff for Porter does. Like, this, I'm sure this is not an isolated incident. You do not send 62 straight text messages and a picture of your dick, you know, just off on a lark, you know? For this one incident that we know of, how many others exist that we just didn't hear about, or that teams just never did anything about, or where the victim in question, you know, never said anything and just kind of, you know, left it on red, so to speak. I don't know. I assume the Mets will, like, I guess that's the thing. If you're the Mets, you know, you've really, I mean, beyond letting go of Porter, which is the obvious and immediate and, you know, the only correct thing to do, I think there really has to be a lot of, you know, reflection, a lot of thinking, a lot of kind of talking about how did we miss this and what can we do next time to make sure this doesn't happen again.
Yeah. Hopefully that is what happens and they take the proper steps and the vetting gets better. But at the very least, the right thing was done. He's gone. And that's probably it for him in baseball. I would hope.
You would hope. But that's the other thing is, like, even if this is it for Jared Porter in baseball, he will be fine. You know, he will find something else. I'm sure he will find some job in some part of the private sector. There's some connection he has, you know, through either his education, but I believe he's a Harvard guy, or through people he knows in baseball. He'll be fine.
No, no, no. Like, are we sure he's not Wheaton? I feel like 2/3 of Major League Baseball GMs went to Wheaton College, an actual college apparently that exists.
But that's the thing. Like, a guy like Jared Porter, like, this is the only consequence he's really going to face. You know, the only consequence he'll face, he loses his job and he's probably out of baseball. But he'll be fine, you know. He'll find a job somewhere else. Maybe somewhere down the road he'll get a semi-cushy, like, you know, redemption story of, I've learned my lesson. I will, you know, I made a mistake. I can't believe I acted that way. Blah, blah. He'll be fine. And so, you know, whereas that reporter, it's like, yes, yeah, you know, Passan and Mina note in their article that, you know, she left the industry. She now works another job. She has moved on, but, you know, again, she is the victim and she had to deal with this. And there was one part in there that just really was hard to read, that she had spent, you know, after Porter began this barrage of texts, how she just had trouble sleeping and had all these anxiety problems. And, you know, this stuff exists well beyond, like, you know, she can leave the industry, but she can't leave any of that behind. And, you know, I hope to a certain degree that she can get some measure of, I don't know if it's really closure, but some sense of, I don't even know. Does it count as justice? You know, I mean, I don't know what, you know, I don't know what, if any, satisfaction or feeling of justice she can get out of this, but I hope there's at least something, you know, because again, this woman had her career taken away from her by this absolute pervert. And that to me is just the hardest part of it, is that, you know, yet another person, yet another woman not feeling like they can actually do the job that they want to do.
Yeah. It's just sad. To transition a little bit to on-field stuff, the Padres acquired another starting pitcher. We talked about that in this podcast. They needed more starting pitching. With Clevinger out, they make a good trade, I think. Trade for Jared Musgrove. What do you think?
Yeah, I think Musgrove is fine. I mean, I don't know if he's ever going to be the guy or become the guy that everyone seemingly, you know, it feels like every year we get a Joe Musgrove is ready to break out story, and then it just never really happens. Obviously, I think people love the fact that he's, you know, he's got he's got that. He's got some pretty good velocity, and I think that goes a long way. Obviously, his average fastball last year was, well, he's got decent. I mean, it was 92, 93, but you know, he's got really good movement on his slider. He's got really good movement on his curveball. He throws a lot at you. You know, he's got good results with his two breaking pitches. There's a lot going on there, and I think that there's probably a feeling that going from a team in Pittsburgh that just never really seems to understand how to get the best out of its players to a team in San Diego that seemingly has a much better grip on player development will probably help. But I mean, that's the thing. He's not going to be asked to be a front of the rotation starter in San Diego. They've already got Yu Darvish. They've got Blake Snell. They've got, if he's healthy, Dinelson Lamet. He's going to be kind of more toward the back of that rotation. I think he's probably going to end up filling the role or attempting to fill the role that Zach Davies did for them last year, which is just kind of a competent, you know, 6 innings, 3 runs, pretty much every night out. I don't know if Musgrove is really in that same build as Davies, but that's kind of the feel I get. I guess the only question you have there is, you know, he had a bad year last year, although some of that seemed to be it kind of took him a little bit to get his velocity. He's never been the healthiest pitcher. He's always been some kind of injury issues. But injury-wise, the one I'm really curious about now is Lamet. Because the way the Padres are stocking up on arms, so it's, you know, they have Darvish, they have Snell, they have Chris Paddock, they have Musgrove, they have Adrian Morahan, they have Mackenzie Gore, they have, you know, it almost makes you feel like, obviously there's no such thing as too many pitchers. You know, in seasons have a way of just wearing down your rotation. But it does make me wonder if Lamet is fully healthy and if this isn't, to a certain degree, a hedge against some potential injury issues with him. So that'll be something interesting to keep an eye on. But otherwise, you know, no, Musgrove's a good pickup. The Padres didn't really have to give much up. They still have not given up a top 100 prospect beyond the kid they sent to Tampa Bay, Luis Patino. In this case, it was, again, mostly a group of teenagers. Hudson Head was kind of the leader of that package. You know, basically the point is they haven't given anything up on their roster that would kind of negatively impact their ability to win this year. It's a good trade for San Diego. It gives them some depth in the rotation, which is always a good thing to have. They don't have to sacrifice any impact pieces for 2021, which is also good. Man, the NL West is going to be crazy this year. It's wild that one of those teams is going to win 100 games and be in the wild card game. Like, straight up, you know, this is that's going to be an interesting year in the NL West
for sure. Maybe not in the back half. I'm pretty low on the Diamondbacks, Rockies, and Giants.
So. Oh no, the rest of the NL West is going to be an absolute mess. Like, they've. Each of those teams has to play the Padres and Dodgers a combined 38 times, and I'm convinced the Rockies are going to go like 5-33 against that group. But it's for everybody else, it's going to suck. But for the Padres and Dodgers, that's going to be a crazy, crazy year. And I think the other thing too with Musgrove is, and again, depends on, you know, it depends on who's healthy, and also something to note is that, you know, as with the case with every team, every pitcher is coming back off of basically only a third of a year's worth of work. So, you know, that going from 60 games to 162 games is going to be kind of tough for a lot of these pitchers with a relatively small number of innings they threw. You know, maybe this is something that opens the door to a six-man rotation in San Diego. I know over at Fangraphs, Ben Clemens wrote about the kind of pros and cons of a six-man rotation, that we may be seeing a little bit more of it this year because of the fact that teams are both, you know, this, I think it's something we've kind of just seen. The teams have just kind of run out of starter depth or just don't have as many starters as they used to. We've already seen that starters pitch fewer innings than before. And like I said, on top of that, now we have to figure out, you know, how do we up the workload again from, you know, guys who topped out at 50, 55 innings at most to all the way back up to 150 plus, you know? How do you do that safely? Maybe it's a six-man rotation. But, you know, we'll just have to wait and see what the Padres do in spring training and how they kind of work things out.
The Nationals keep signing vets. They signed John Lester to a deal. What do you think of that?
Fine. I mean, John Lester at this stage in his career is a back of the rotation starter. I would not be surprised if this is the last year of his career. I don't know necessarily that he's going to be any better than maybe a 4.5 ERA. You know, his velocity is going down. His strikeout rate is very low. It was really bad last year for the Cubs. granted, he's still probably better than Eric Fetty, maybe better than Joe Ross, where the two guys kind of at the back of the Nationals rotation right now. It just feels to me like a move where it's just like, it just seems like they're valuing what he was over what he currently is. I don't necessarily know, you know, without taking a deep look at the starting pitcher still available, which is to say mostly everybody, that there was, you know, there might have been a veteran option that they might have preferred toward the back of the rotation. But Lester very much is at this point in his career just kind of end of the rotation, like filler, which is sad because, you know, he had a great career. He has had a great career. Now, obviously, you know, as a Red Sox fan, I loved what he did in Boston. Cubs fans love what he did for them, but he's not an impact player anymore. And I think the best you can assume if you're the Nationals is maybe, you know, 120 innings of roughly league average pitching, which has its use. But this is a team that still is pretty thin in pitching depth. So I would assume, and if I were a Nationals fan, I would hope that Lester is not the end of their offseason pitching acquisition, especially because, you know, the rest of that rotation is like Max Scherzer is looking a little more mortal and is going to be 37 this year. Steven Strasburg obviously missed all of last year with an injury. Patrick Corbin was not very good last year. Again, as I noted, Fetty and Ross and the kind of back of the rotation offense are not very strong. Their pitching prospects are not ready to take up the, you know, to kind of fill those holes yet. I think the closest one they had to the majors was Will Crow, who they traded in part for Josh Bell. So, you know, I think they still got more work to do. Lester's a decent option, but yeah, I think you kind of have to do more than that though, because, you know, this rotation, when it's healthy, it's great, but, you know, there's a lot of potential downside there too, or a lot of potential room for failure. I don't know what I'm trying to say, but you get what I'm trying to say.
Yeah. Corey Kluber, last note here before we get into the Detroit Tigers, signs with the Yankees. Rich get richer, or is this just one of those where we're like, yeah, he's probably not gonna be very good and we're just not gonna remember that this was a thing in a few months?
I mean, we don't know because he didn't pitch last year basically, and he has barely pitched since 2018. You know, there's still a lot of upside obviously because this is a guy who's won two Cy Young awards. He was obviously a very, very, very good pitcher once upon a time. I don't think it's out of the question that the Yankees could get something close to that back. I think what you have to wonder is how much these injuries have kind of sapped him overall. You saw better velocity last year, be it extremely briefly, than what he was doing in 2019. I don't know. There's obviously, again, it's Corey Kluber. There's a lot of upside. I think the Yankees still need to add more because Corey Kluber is not someone you can really count on again because of the injuries.
Trevor Bauer, but come on down.
Certainly, but certainly, like, this is a move. Like, this is a move you would expect a team like the Yankees to make. Kind of one of the. Like, it's similar to me to what the Braves kind of did with Drew Smyly and Charlie Morton. Like, you bet on the upside at a relatively cheap rate, you know, to see if you can get a $20 million pitcher for $10 million. And I think part of that, too, is like there just aren't a lot of pitchers available in free agency right now. There are guys like Mike Leake who you can count on for 160 innings. They're just going to be 160 pretty mediocre innings. So it's almost like, what do you find more valuable, 160 mediocre innings or 100 high-quality innings where you have to fill in the rest with, you know, the likes of Clark Schmidt or maybe Davey Garcia or, you know, whoever doesn't make the Yankees rotation out of spring training. And I think if you're a team like the Yankees where your roster is pretty well set and where you feel like maybe you still need some depth, but you don't need to sign a guy like Trevor Bauer because you already have a guy like Gerrit Cole, you can bet instead on let's try to catch the upside as opposed to let's go for safe veteran mediocrity. It's kind of the opposite of what the Red Sox did with Martin Perez, which is they just bet on a guy who is just base competence, you know, who is very average, but who will eat innings, which is really what that rotation needs, as opposed to the Yankees, who also need innings eaten, but have a somewhat higher kind of starting point than the Red Sox do in that regard.
Yeah. Well, we shall see how it all unfolds for that young upstart group over there in New York. The Detroit Tigers. It's time for our preview series / review series, depending on which way you're looking at it. They finished 23-35 in 2020. Does that record sound about right to you? Dead last in the AL Central. Was that about what you expected from them last year?
What I expected, yes. And the funny thing is that their Pythagorean record for 2020 was 23-35.
Nice.
That translates That translates to, I believe, a 64-win season, which also feels right for the Tigers, who are still really deep in that rebuild. They really have they've only graduated a handful of guys to the majors who look like they have any place with kind of a future good Tigers team. Most of that's in the rotation. The problem they ran into is they had the worst pitching staff in baseball by ERA, one of the worst rotations in baseball, a bullpen that really didn't have much in the way of impact arms, and that the guys they did graduate in Tarik Skubal and Casey Mize got their brains beaten in for the brief period they were in the majors. On the one hand, like, that's not the end of the world. They're both 23 years old last year. Like, you know, there are going to be growing pains for pitchers. On the other hand, you never like seeing guys come up and just get absolutely whomped on. So that's going to be, you know, and I think that's a question of, okay, was it jitters and growing pains and adjustments, or was it there's something fundamentally not working here? I can't say for sure. I really did not watch a whole lot of Tigers baseball, as I imagine most non-Tigers fans, as I imagine is probably true for most non-Tigers fans. And I don't believe I caught any of Skubal or Mize's start, so I can't say with any certainty that, you know, there's something there that's, you know, there's a red flag there. I would probably, if, you know, just totally blind, just chalk that up to, and I know we were going to talk more about Mize and Skubal, but I figured, you know, now feels like the appropriate time. I would wager that some of that is probably just like making the adjustment to the majors. You know, they lost out on any ability to develop in, you know, in the minors during the 2020 season. They kind of came up a little cold. I assume that a regular offseason, regular development will probably also help. But otherwise, like, yeah, there's you just look at last year's Tigers team. There's not a whole lot of talent here. And so a 64-win season with the worst pitching staff in baseball, yeah, that feels about right.
Yeah, it does, and it's just it's going to be a long rebuild. And just the AL Central, you tweeted out the NL Central is just so sad, and I was like, well, I raise you the AL Central.
Well, at least the AL Central has two good teams on top of it. The NL Central is just one endless 82-win blob. Yeah, the White Sox and the Twins.
We'll see. I don't know about the White Sox. White Sox could easily implode. There's an easy path to the White Sox implosion. I'm not.
Oh, sure. The White Sox definitely have more upside than I think any of the NL Central teams do at this point.
Ooh, interesting. I don't know if I agree with that, but I'm not.
I mean, definitely than the Cubs and the Pirates and the
yes.
Brewers.
Brewers, I don't know. Brewers and Cardinals, I don't know. And Reds, I don't know. I think they're very Redsy.
I think I would feel better about the Cardinals and the Brewers if they actually did something this offseason.
Yeah.
As far as I can tell, neither of them have done a single thing aside from just let some guys walk in free agency. And in the case of the Cardinals, just get rid of Colton Wong because they could. So, yeah, I think the White Sox would be the best team in the NL Central if you just randomly plop them in there, but. Regardless, I mean, this is the thing. Like, again, the Tigers, you look at that, you can tell too, but just by looking at their roster, that they're in the middle of a deep rebuild, because a lot of these guys, you know, from last year's roster or looking at next year's roster, the talent here is just, these are a lot of quad A guys. These are a lot of young dudes who are just kind of, they're very much in that plug them in and let's see stage of the rebuild, where you're just kind of collecting players from, you know, through waivers, through the Rule 5 draft, through the trades you've made, just scouring the minors, and just kind of seeing what they're capable of, you know. Contending teams, good teams, even mediocre teams, are not giving regular at-bats to Grayson Grainer and Nico Goodrum and Isaac, well, I guess Isaac Paredes is a prospect, but, or it's like Harold Castro, you know. These are just guys, you know. This is a whole bunch of guys. But I imagine, obviously, the hope for the Tigers is eventually that will not be the case, but, I mean, truthfully, I guess that's the other side of the Tigers thing. It's like, we really haven't seen any semblance of, like, good player development from them yet. No one they've called up over the past year and change has really shown anything at the major league level. I think Spencer Turnbull is probably their best pitching development story now, or I guess it would have been Matt Boyd. But he kind of fell apart last year, although I think he can bounce back. Michael Fulmer obviously has gone completely sideways.
Well, hold on. Turnbull, I think a 6 FIP is fine. I think you can move that in the right direction. Can't get much worse. It's on the up and up.
It can't get much worse. And I know we're going to talk about Fulmer, but there's a lot of stuff in his profile that just makes me think that there's not really much upside left in him. But it just feels like when your best development story currently is Spencer Turnbull, that's not a great sign. You know, and I know they're still early in this, but like they really, we really have yet to see any signs of what the next good Tigers team is going to look like or who's even going to be on it. And I know obviously they have a lot of good prospects down in the minors. You know, they have Mize and Stubal, who will probably be in the rotation this year. They have the number one pick from last summer in Spencer Torkelson. They have Paredes, who's already up. They have their best position player prospect beyond Torkelson and Riley Green. I can't remember if it's, I think it was it Alex Fado or Matt Manning who blew out his elbow? I think it was Alex Fado.
I think so.
Which hurts, but like, and also kind of raises the issue that like, it was Fado. That when you, and this is kind of the thing, like the Tigers seem to have been built on pitching prospects, but this is, it's a good thing to remember, pitchers break. Pitchers break all the time. It's really, really, really hard to develop pitching. And for as much as I assume some Tigers fans had dreams of a Mize, Skubal, Manning, Fado, like maybe Fulmer, who really cares at that point, rotation, you know, it's really hard to get there. And I think that's where you kind of worry that the Tigers aren't really producing much in the way of position player prospects, especially because at this point they have nothing left to trade. You know, Boyd is really it. And he's going to be, they need him to have a great first half to make that work. Because otherwise they'd be selling very low. You know, other than him, like, you know, maybe you see what's out there for, Daniel Norris, Joe Jimenez. I don't know. Like, there's just not a whole lot on this. There's just not a whole lot of talent on this team yet. This, it reminds me of Baltimore, you know, I know where, well, I guess Baltimore's probably the best because, you know, similar teardown stakes, similar situation. I think it also hurts too, that a lot of those teardown trades that the Tigers made, they really did not get a whole lot back. You know, just when they dismantled those old, like, I think the 20, when was the last good Tigers team? 2017, 2016? It's been a bit. 2016 was really the last time the Tigers were, you could even say, remotely competitive. But realistically, it's 2014 was the last time they won the division. But even from that 2016 team, you know, the players they traded away or that they let go, you know, they, Ian Kinsler, Nick Castellanos, Justin Upton, J.D. Martinez, Victor Martinez was just got old, Verlander, you know, none of those moves really panned out into anything. I mean, Castellanos brought back Paredes, or did he bring back Paredes? Who did Castellanos bring? No, Castellanos brought back, just scrolling now. He brought back two minor leaguers who, you know, we haven't really heard anything from yet. I think, I mean, they got Jaime Candelario, and as one of those trades, I know you wanted to talk about Candelario, and he seems to be at least productive, or at least like he has you can see some productivity if you squint. He was part of the Justin Wilson trade, as was Isaac Brady, so that was actually a nice one to Detroit. But, you know, the Verlander trade has not panned out. The Castellanos trade has not really returned anything yet. It just seems like in a lot of ways they just kind of whiffed on a lot of these moves. You know, and now they don't really have anything left to move. Upton too. I mean, Upton was basically salary dumped. He was an August waiver trade. You know, they got very little out of that. You know.
Yeah, I don't know, man. It's all bad. None of that was positive. Like that entire rendition, John, is all
no,
bad.
No, and it feels like the Tigers kind of had the same fate befall them as the Ruben Amaro Phillies, where they just kind of waited too long and didn't get enough. And so now they're, you know, which makes the rebuild that much harder, because doing this without top prospects is, like I said, you just end up kind of just sifting through a lot of dirt, you know, like you're prospecting gold in a stream, you know, you're just shaking through a lot of dirt and rocks and mineral waste to find the occasional nuggets. And the Tigers have not really done well with that so far, which is kind of the other thing, like of the minor league signings and Rule 5 picks and trades they made. Again, you look at that 2020 roster and you just don't really see, or you look at that 2020 roster and you look at the 2020 roster, you're just not really seeing those pieces yet. You're seeing a lot of really flawed players who are really only playing because there's nobody else here. You know, Jacoby Jones and and Nico Goodrum are not getting playing time because they've necessarily earned it. They're getting playing time because there's no one else the Tigers really have that works here. You know, because if they're not playing, then it's Jorge Bohr. And that's the other thing. Like, you know, granted, signing Robbie Grossman is, I think that's a good move. You know, teams like this need basic competency of positions, and Robbie Grossman is the avatar of basic competency. The problem is you're doing it because you had a prospect in Kristen Stewart who has just been a total disaster so far and is so defensively incompetent that you can't put him in the outfield on a regular basis. You know, it's one thing to sign Robbie Grossman because you just don't have anyone ready to play that spot. It's another thing to sign Robbie Grossman when the options you've already tried, who were your top prospects, simply are not working out. You know, that to me is kind of the concerning thing about the Tigers, is that, you know, what they've done so far really has not panned out in any way, with the exception of, as I noted, a couple of guys scattered across the roster.
Who are you higher on, Willie Castro or Yaimer Candelario?
Probably Candelario, who has had a better profile as a prospect. In just doing some research for this, I took a look at last year's Tigers prospect list over on Fangraphs, and Eric Longenhagen had Willie Castro as basically the kind of Freddie Galvis 2.0, which seems appropriate to me. But the main takeaway from that is there's no real reason to be excited about Freddie Galvis, who has been basically league average his entire career. And I know there's something to be said about being able to plug in a guy who can get the job done, but guys like Galvis have no upside. You know, they are just one war players indefinitely, and that just doesn't really help you. You know, it just means you're not playing a worse player, but you're also not really, you know, and that's not to say like that, you know, the Tigers shouldn't play Willie Castro. They should, because they should see what they have in Willie Castro. I would just imagine that, you know, because of, you know, just looking at his numbers, and he's not a power hitter. He does not have play patience. He's, by the numbers, he's ranked out as a pretty mediocre defender, if not bad. You know, there doesn't seem like there is a whole lot of hidden upside here, and that the greater likelihood is that he just does end up developing into Freddie Galvis, as opposed to Candelario, who does have some power. The problem with both Candelario and Castro is they both had, you know, good surface numbers last year, but a lot of that was built on extremely high batting average on balls and play numbers. And neither of them really show much in the way of plate patience. So, you know, especially with looking through Candelario's numbers, you notice that, you know, he really killed fastballs last year. His pitchers kind of, you know, he killed pitches in the heart of the strike zone. I wonder if, you know, it's going to be a lot tougher for him next year if pitchers adjust and are like, okay, there's no reason to get this guy a fastball. Or at least there's no reason to get this guy a fastball in the strike zone. Pitch him outside, throw him a ton of breaking balls, make him chase, make him work, you know. I'd probably still say Candelario is like the better bet, because he has, I think, slightly higher upside. But ultimately, both of those guys kind of feel like second division starters, and I'd be surprised if either of them is the centerpiece of the next good Tigers team. I think they're more likely to be the kind of complementary pieces that fill out a roster, as opposed to kind of foundational building block pieces, for sure.
To wrap up on the Tigers, 2021 expectations, and do you think any of the young pitchers really break out for them this year?
I think 2021 is probably the same as 2020. If we get a full season, I think this team wins somewhere between 60 and 70 games, which is just not enough talent here for them to be anything better than that. Obviously, the thing everyone is keeping an eye on, or at least that I think is the most worth keeping an eye on, is the rotation. Spencer Turnbull is a nice mid-rotation starter. I think, obviously, again, it'll be really useful to see whether or not Matt Boyd can rediscover, you know, his prior success. Like I said, I am very low on Fulmer. His velocity is completely shot coming off Tommy John surgery. That might pick up with a full off season of preparation and with, you know, the further he gets away from the surgery. But until you see that velocity go back up, I don't really think there's any reason to expect any better from him. It's really just seeing what can Mize and Skubal and Manning do eventually. And that's not going to be nearly enough to get this team to be anywhere close to good. I think at least one of those guys should probably pan out. But again, pitching is hard. Developing pitching is really hard. I mean, you saw it yourself with the Brandon Beachy, Mike Minor combination, you know. I always remember Yankees fans crowing about the Phil Hughes, Jabba Chamberlain, Andrew Brackman, like Dellin Betances, Manny Benuelos rotation that never happened. Like, things happen. Shit happens to young pitchers. And so I think, you know, what happens obviously with those three guys, with Mize and Skubal and Manning in particular, and now with, well, I mean, Torkelson's not a pitcher, but obviously he's part of that too, is really going to determine what future the Tigers are looking at. Because if those three guys all bust, oh boy, this is going to be a bad team for quite a long time.
Get excited, Tigers fans.
You know what's weird, too? Talking about the Detroit Tigers and not once mentioning Miguel Cabrera, who has just disappeared into the ether. It's, I know that obviously was going to happen. Everyone gets old. Everyone breaks down. But, man, that's just depressing what has happened to poor Miggy, who can still hit. That's the crazy thing. He can still hit. He just can't hit as well as he used to because everything south of his hips is just, like, made of rusted metal. So
there you go. Get excited, folks, the Detroit Tigers. All right, John, is there anything you would like to plug before you wrap up here?
Nah, I think I'm all set. Nothing really going on aside from, you know, just wait. Hopefully now that we've seen a few more guys sign over the last few days, maybe things are starting to kind of thaw a little bit with the free agent market, but who knows at this point. I'm hoping
it seems
that
like Springer's going to sign this week.
Yeah, I was going to say hopefully by this time next week we have a George Springer signing to talk about. But, yeah, I guess we'll have to wait and see as we have been for the entire damn winter.
George Springer, future Atlanta Brave. Very excited about it. All right, John
nice.
Taylor, for that guy.
I don't know
guy.
Why you're telling me.
You got to do it. You got to make yourself happy in these trying times, John. For that guy up there in Manhattan, New York, you can follow him at J.A. Taylor and read his stuff and read Fangraphs.com and support Fangraphs if you're not already a member. Go to Fangraphs.com today. Go check out ChaseThomasPodcast.com. And if you like today's show, you know what to do. Leave a 5-star rating and a review. Fisher, the dog, would greatly appreciate it. I would also like it. John, thank you as always, my friend. Talk to you soon.
Yep.
Nicely done, nephew. Chase Thomas Podcast. Hell yeah.
Sugar Ray Leonard, Roberto Duran, Marvelous Marvin Hagler, and Thomas Hearns. Legends, whose four-way rivalry defined one of the greatest eras in boxing history. Relive their decade of dominance in the new Showtime sports documentary, The Kings, a four-part series premiering Sunday, June 6th, only on Showtime.